Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour Editorial Review is sponsored by the Gordon Law School at Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week in more than 112 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on education and indoctrination right after this. Hey, when you're making $50,000 a year, you're paying $7,650 in Social Security taxes. Then, on top of that, you pay 17% income tax on that same $50,000. Now, that's another $8,500. Now, you just paid an extra $1,300 by paying your tax on a tax. Now, that makes the real, effective Social Security tax 17.8%. It's not the 15.3% that's being advertised. Now, isn't that just real special? If you'd like more information about tax and status, call us here at the law school. That's 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Help take a bite out of crime. Call and ask for my free general law CD package. It's a four-hour commentary on the law school. And remember, it's educational, it's entertaining, informative, and best of all, it's free. Now, tax and status, our school is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. And click onto the email, send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now while you're thinking about it. All right, we're reviewing education and indoctrination from the book Poison Drops in the Federal Senate. And last time we talked about the direct correlation between the dollars spent on public education and the increase in crime. Now, in addition to that, there are several other categories of social problems, such as criminality, poverty, insanity, murder, suicide, unemployment. These social problems grow in direct proportion to the amount of money we spend on public education in the public schools in what this author calls the anti-parental school system. Anti-parental school system, the non-parental, the absent parent school, the no parent school. But there's more to be said. In chapter 6, he points out that in our California public schools, as in those of most of the other states, Webster's dictionary is the legally established authority for the definition of words. Now, this would all be well enough if the Webster of today were the Webster of 25 years ago, but it's not. And the illustrious and patriotic Noah Webster would blush in his grave at the thought of being made to father the bastard brood of political heresies which are now being taught in our public schools through the medium of a false, forged, and mutilated dictionary bearing his honored name. Now, to show you how the overthrow of constitutional liberty and the inestimable right of democratic self-government are being brought about by changing the meaning of words, let me give you a few examples from Webster's dictionary. Let's take, for example, the word constitution. Now, Webster's unabridged dictionary, as published in 1859, in giving the legal definition of the word constitution, puts it this way, quote, in free states, the Constitution is paramount to the statutes or laws enacted by the legislature, limiting and controlling its power. And in the United States, the legislature is created and its powers designated by the Constitution, unquote. But every word of the above definition has been expunged from the Webster now used and required by law to be used in our public schools. And in its place, we find the following definition of the word Constitution, to wit. It now reads, quote, it is the principle or fundamental law which govern a state or other organized body of men and are embodied in written documents or implied in the institutions or usages of the country or society, unquote. So, under public school tuition, the rising generation no longer look upon the written constitution as the source and limit of legislative power. But on the contrary, they view it now as the mere usages of society and are raised to the dignity of constitutional law. Now, what a very convenient way of clothing official villainy in the garb of constitutional authority. After our corrupt and perjured officials have violated in 100 ways the Constitution that they had solemnly sworn to support in order to carry out their nefarious schemes of fraud and plunder, how would it have been possible for them to have contrived a more ingenious device to justify in the eyes of the rising generation their official misdeeds than by thus adopting, legalizing, and then forcing into the public school through their willing tools a definition of the word Constitution sufficiently elastic to cover every species of their accustomed rascalities. Again, the old Noah Webster of 25 years ago, in giving to a definition for the word union, says its political signification defines it as states united. Thus, the United States of America are sometimes called the Union, unquote. But in the false and the mutilated Webster's dictionary of today, which the public school system now forces upon our children to study, this definition is entirely suppressed. And in its place, we now have the word union defined as meaning, quote, a consolidated body as the United States of America are often called the Union, unquote. Thus, while the real statesmen of both political parties are warning our people against the danger of a consolidated government, the children who are soon to take the places of these statements through our public school machinery are being indoctrinated with the idea that we already have a consolidated republic. Now, in the case of McCulloch versus the state of Maryland, Chief Justice Marshall of the Supreme Court of the United States said, quote, no political dreamer was ever wild enough to think of breaking down the lines which separate the states and of compounding the American people into a solid mass, unquote. But what no political dreamer was ever wild enough to think of in Judge Marshall's day is now taught as an accomplished fact in our public schools. Now again, Webster's dictionary of 25 years ago defined the word federal as consisting in a compact between parties, particularly and chiefly between states and nations, formed on alliance by contract or mutual agreement as a federal government, such as that of the United States, unquote. But the present public school Webster, after expunging every syllable of this definition just quoted, defines federal as being, quote, specifically composed of states and which retain only a subordinate and a limited sovereignty as the Union of the United States and a Sonderbund of Switzerland, unquote. Now, a moment's reflection will show that under such a definition of the word federal, the several states composing the American Union would have no rights and no sovereignty which the general government would be bound to respect. Now, it is undoubtedly true that in all of those matters in which under the Constitution the federal government has been clothed with sovereign authority, the authority of the states is indeed subordinate to that federal government. But in all things else, the sovereignty of the states is as supreme and as independent of the federal sovereignty as if the federal sovereignty had never existed. Now, in the celebrated Dred Scott case, the United States Supreme Court said this. They said, quote, the principles upon which our governments rest and upon which alone they continue to exist is the union of states, sovereign and independent within their own limits in their internal and domestic concerns, unquote. But if, as now being taught in our public schools in California and elsewhere, the states have no sovereignty except such as is subordinate to the sovereignty of the United States, what then becomes of our sovereign right to local self-government? Suppose that the federal government should tomorrow, in the exercise of its supposed superior sovereignty, undertakes to nullify our state constitution and laws, abrogate our state government, remove from office our governor, abolish our state courts and our legislature, and then force us to accept for our local government just such laws as the federal Congress might choose to give us, such state, county, and municipal officers as the president might send to rule over us. What remedy, then, should we have? Shall I be told that such action on the part of the federal government, clashing as it would with the principles of state sovereignty, would not be tolerated? But I would answer, if a state possesses no sovereignty except such as is subordinate to the sovereignty of the federal government, would not our subordinate sovereignty be forced to yield to the superior sovereignty to which it is subordinate? Is it not a law of nature that whenever two unequal forces meet, the inferior force must yield to the superior? My countrymen, disguise the fact as we may, there is in this country today, and in both political parties, an element which is ripe for a centralized despotism. There are men and corporations of vast wealth whose iron grasp spans this entire continent and who find it more difficult and more expensive to corrupt 30-odd state legislatures than one federal Congress. Now, it was said of Nero of old that he wished the Roman people had but one head so that he might cut it off at a single blow. And so it is with those moneyed kings who would rule this country through bribery, fraud, and intimidation. I want to remind you that this book was written in 1886. So we're not talking about Bill Clinton and George Bush or the Patriot Act and Homeland Security. We're talking about the central school system inaugurated in California in 1874 and being taken to task by Zach Montgomery in this treatise written in 1886. And he said, this public school system that we're getting out of New England is a piece of crap, destined to bring upon us a despotism. Well, boys and girls, wake up to reality and smell the coffee, because here it is. Now, our children have already been taught out of these dictionaries. We've already been exposed to, we have already been transformed into practicing communists. Zach Montgomery hadn't even heard of that twist yet. He hadn't heard about Franklin D. Roosevelt and House Joint Resolution 192 and the confiscation of our gold and then our silver by Lyndon Johnson. He hadn't been aware of that yet. He went on to say, it is easy to see how, with all of the powers of government centered in Washington and one federal head, they could at a single stroke put an end to American liberty. But they well understand that before striking this blow, the minds of the people must be prepared to receive it. Now, what surer or safer preparation could possibly be made than is now being made by indoctrinating the minds of our children in the rising generation with the idea that ours is already a consolidated government, that the states of the Union have no sovereignty, which is not subordinate to the will and pleasure of the federal head, and that our Constitution is the mere creature of the custom and may therefore be legally altered or abolished by custom. Now, such are few of the pernicious and poisonous doctrines which 10 million of American children are today drinking in with the very definitions of the words that they are compelled to study. And yet the man who dares to utter a word of warning of the approaching danger is stigmatized as an enemy to education and unfit to be mentioned as a candidate for the humblest office. Well, be it so. Viewing this great question as I do, not for all of the offices and the gift of the American people, would I shrink from an open and candid avowal of my sentiments. If I have learned anything from the reading of history, it is that the man who, in violation of great principles, toils for temporary fame, purchases for himself either total oblivion or eternal infamy, while he who temporarily goes down battling for right principles always deserves and generally secures the gratitude of succeeding ages, and will carry with him the sustaining solace of a clean conscience, more precious than all of the offices and honors in the gift of man. Now, history tells us that Aristides was voted into banishment because he was just. And yet, who would not 1,000 times rather today be Aristides than be numbered amongst the proudest of his persecutors? Socrates also, in violation of every principle of justice, was condemned to a dungeon and to death. And yet that name, Socrates, is more honored in history today, and which of his unjust judges would not gladly hide himself in the utter darkness of oblivion than from withering scorn and contempt of all of mankind today? Now, from the noble example of Aristides and Socrates, let American statesmen learn wisdom. And from the undying infamy of their cowardly time-serving persecutors, let political demagogues of this day take warning. Now, what this man is talking about in 1886 not only is an accomplished fact today, but 10 times over. That was just the pabulum of the conspiracy against the American Republic. In 1933, Franklin D. Roosevelt began to introduce the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. Now, remember, the first plank to the Communist Manifesto calls for the abolition of all right to property and land. And the American people had been prepared between 1886 and 1923 to accept the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. Had they tried to impose such a dastardly doctrine in the 1880s, I think it would have spawned a revolution. But they didn't. They instead began changing dictionary definitions. It still goes on today. But by changing the educational system in the 1880s to accommodate and to accept these concepts of watering down our Republican form of government, set us up for the ensuing democracy. Then once we accepted democracy through the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, we were then set up to exact and to expect, and then to accept communism, all 10 planks. Then from the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, the school children, I being chief among them, were all indoctrinated into communism, and we all accepted it. The 10th plank to the Communist Manifesto calls for the free education of all children in public schools. The first plank calls for the abolition of all right to property in land. We don't own our homes and houses. Boys and girls, you all pay a property tax. You're renting that from the government. You rent it from your county, from your state. Just don't pay your rent on your house and see what happens to you. You register your car. That's the rent that you pay to drive the state's vehicle. It's no longer a conveyance, boys and girls. It's now a vehicle. And you've been taught to accept these definitions, to accept licensing. License now is permission to do something that's illegal, unlawful, a tort, or trespass. Had our government come to the people in the 1880s and said, we want to license you to drive, we want to license you to travel, we want to license you to conduct a business, I think the people would have revolted. They didn't. Instead, they changed definitions and prepared the people to accept communism at a later date. It's a step-by-step process over a long period of time that has been inculcated into the minds of Americans. Americans today are practicing communists, no doubt about it. In this country, we practice all 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. You Canadians and Australians and New Zealanders do the same thing. You just call it different names, different terms. Jesus once made an observation. He said, you will know them by their fruits, not by their much speaking and their smooth words, but what do these people do? Now, every standard writer on the subject of either law or morals proclaims with one voice that parents are bound by the natural law to feed, clothe, and educate their children. Bouvier says that the principal obligation which parents owe their children are their maintenance, their protection, and their education. Chancellor Kent says the duties of parents in their children as being their natural guardians consist in maintaining and educating them during their season of infancy and youth. Sir William Blackstone says the last duty of parents to their children is that of giving them an education suitable to their station in life, a duty pointed out by reason, and of far the greatest importance of any. For, continues the author, Lord Blackstone, as Pufendorf very well observes, it is not easy to imagine or allow that a parent has conferred any considerable benefit upon his child by bringing him into the world if he afterwards entirely neglects his culture and education and suffers him to grow up like a mere beast, to lead a life useless to others and shameful to himself. Dr. Wayland, in his Elements of Moral Science, says this, the duty of parents is generally to educate or to bring up their children in such manner as they believe will be most for their future happiness, both temporal and eternal. Again, he, the parent, is bound to inform himself of the peculiar habits and reflect upon the probable future situation of his child and deliberately to consider what sort of education will most conduce to his future happiness and usefulness. Again, the duties of a parent are established by God, and God requires us not to violate them. And according to the law of God, says Wayland, the teacher is only the agent, the parent is the principal. But under the New England system, as by law established, the parent is not recognized as the principal, nor is the teacher regarded as his agent. The legislature of California has gone so far towards elevating the teacher above the parents as to make it a penal offense for any parent to even insult the teacher of a public school in the presence of his pupils, no difference what the provocation may be. In Section 654 of the Penal Code of the State of California, it says every parent, guardian, or other person who upbraids, who insults, or abuses any teacher of the public schools in the presence or hearing of a pupil thereof is guilty of a misdemeanor. So if the teacher insults the parent in the presence of the children, there isn't any penalty to pay. Or if the dirtiest loafer in the land insults the teacher of a private school without the least cause or provocation, that's okay. That's not a crime. But woe be to the father or mother who has the temerity to breathe one offensive word against the teacher of a public school or in the hearing of his pupils, even should it be to chide him for his immoral conduct towards the child of the offender. Now, in his biennial report for 1864, our state superintendent of public instruction, quoting from the judicial decisions of some of the eastern states, construing their public school laws, which are in all respects similar to our own here in California, maintains the proposition that the child should be taught to consider his instructor in many respects superior to the parent in point of authority, and that the vulgar impression that parents have a legal right to dictate to teachers is entirely erroneous, and further, that parents have no remedy as against the teacher. Unquote. Let's pause here and think about this for a second. You have a child, and in your view, you believe that the child should do A, B, and C. Teacher says, oh, no, we don't think that's true at all. And you say, well, I'm the parent, so therefore I'm going to jerk my kid out of the school. I'm going to do this, that, or another thing. Oh, my God, woe be unto you, parent, because we follow the doctrine of parens patre, parens patre. Now, we were warned about this many, many years ago. In fact, it was about, 3,000 years ago. You can read this warning in 1 Samuel chapter 8. The people got a little uppity with Samuel, the first judge. Now, Samuel was the chief judge in Israel at the time. Everything seemed to be going along pretty well, but the people had been listening to their elders. They had been listening to their princes. They had been listening to their politicians, the Dianne Feinsteins and Barbara Boxers and Ted Kennedys of the era. And they came to the conclusion that what they needed in the country was a king like all the nations around us. That's what they said. We want a king like all the nations around us. So they came to Samuel and they said, hey, we want a king. We want to change our government. And Samuel was just shocked. So he went to God and he said, now listen, have you heard what these people are asking for? They want a king like all the nations around us. That's like saying, we want a Federal Reserve Bank like all the nations of Europe. We want a standing army in this country like all the nations of the world. We want a stock market and we want commercial paper like all of the rest of the nations around us. So God sat down with Samuel, and he gave him a heart-to-heart talk. He said, Sam, wake up. Smell the coffee, son. They're not bitching about you. They're bitching about me. It's me that they don't want to reign over them. Not you, Sam. They're not complaining about you. They're complaining about me. And he went on to say, he said, from the time I brought them out of Egypt, they have rebelled against me. They give me the finger. They won't do a damn thing I tell them. So he said, hearken unto their voice. Listen to them. Pay attention. Let's give them a king. Let's give them what they want. I'm not going to sit here and argue with them. We'll give them what they want. We'll let them decide what kind of government they want. And then in verse 18 or 19, he says, and in that day, you know, he warned us. He told Samuel, give these people a warning for me. You tell them, the day will come when they will cry out to me. You know, when you people get enough of George Bush, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and John McCain, when you get enough of Bill Clinton and Bush 1 and the communism that they brought upon you, you'll cry out to God in this Great Depression when you've lost your shirt and you've lost everything. It's the way you people are always geared up. You know, you eat pig until you get cancer, and then you cry out to God. You give him the finger until a hurricane comes, and then you pray mightily. And he said in verse 19, he said, in that day, because of the king that they shall have set up over them, he said, they will cry out to me, and in that day I will not hear them. So when I have a student come here, I tell him, well, you can save your breath. You don't need to waste your time praying to Jesus. He already told you. He ain't listening to this crap. He's had it. Pay attention now. So back in 1886, we did the same thing here that we did back in ancient times. I mean, we came out of the revolution with a Republican form of government. We had the world by the short hairs. And like the prodigal son, we threw it away. And, you know, we didn't throw it away over Bill Clinton and George Bush. This has been going on for a long time. And this fellow, Zach Montgomery, put his finger right on the pulse of the problem. And he said, it's public school. It's the 10th plank to the Communist Manifesto. It's a usurpation of the parental authority of the family, mom and dad, by the state that's going to bring upon you your destruction. That's the New England public school system. That's the anti-parent system. Now, boys and girls, you've got social lady out there knocking on your door asking you how you're raising your kids. You got the doctrine of parens patre working against you. You got marriage licenses so that the state can come in and regulate your marriage in a three-party limited general partnership. How you like it? Your divorce rate's running 66% here in this country, kids. And your crime and juvenile delinquency is off the charts and has been for 50 or 75 years. Hell, it's been so bad for so long we're used to it and we think it's normal. That's right. It's so bad and has been for so long. We've just gotten used to it. We don't know anything else. We lock ourselves up in our cities behind bars. We lock ourselves behind bars to protect us from the criminals, for crying out loud. And we think that's just normal as ABC, and we accept it in this country. All right, it's halfway time here. I've got to give you a reminder that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 112 countries daily over the Internet and radio. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by pre-arrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has our radio log schedule and archives, and that can also be accessed through the website. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Once again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that these authors or publications that we endorse will necessarily reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or of this local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing the book, Poison Drops in the Federal Senate. Let me give you a name and address that you can go to if you want to get a copy of the document itself. It's written by a guy named Zach Montgomery, Z-A-C-H, Montgomery. It was compiled by Montgomery from the United States Census reports and from his own writing. And it was first published as a, I believe it was first published as an article in the North American Review in December of 1880. The North American Review of December of 1880. Then it was copyrighted in 1886 by Montgomery and printed by Gibson Brothers Printers and Bookbinders in 1886. That's Gibson Brothers Printers and Bookbinders, 1886. It was then reprinted by the St. Thomas Press, Post Office Box 35096, Houston, Texas. The zip code is 77235. The first printing was made in 1968 and the second printing in 1983. And the total text covers 138 pages. All right, once more, that's reprinted by the St. Thomas Press, Post Office Box 35096, Houston, Texas, 77235. Now, in the state of Vermont, back in 1874, a school committee expelled from a public school certain children because of their absence from school on a religious holiday. And although they had remained absent in obedience to the commands of their parents, and this too was after the school authorities had been appealed to in vain for leave of absence, this action of the school committee was afterwards sustained by the Supreme Court of the state, which based its decision in part at least on the grounds that no divine authority had been quoted or asserted to sustain the right claimed by these parents. I'll pause here and point out that we still use that doctrine today, and you'll find it in Seeger versus United States, and there are 10 standards or 10 points that you have to adhere to in making a claim for religious exemption or religious free exercise. Seeger versus U.S., 1964. 380 U.S. 163. Now, the law of nature and of nature's God, which ordains that it is both the right and duty of parents to educate their children in such manner as they believe will be most or do most for their children's future happiness, is totally disregarded and set at naught by the state, which ordains that it is neither the right nor the duty of parents, but of the state to say when, where, by whom, and in what manner our children shall be educated. Now, it is always possible for either individuals or states to disregard and to violate nature's laws, but it is not possible to do so without suffering, either sooner or later, a penalty, and a penalty too corresponding in magnitude with the importance of the law violated. Hence it is, and we assert it without the fear of successful contradiction, that those communities which have so long and so glaringly violated nature's laws in the matter of education are now reaping so heavy and so deadly a harvest of crime, pauperism, insanity, and suicides. Let me pause right here. I pointed this out before. In Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28 are the two penal clause statutes. God, the Creator, has pointed out very, very clearly, in my view, very clearly, there's no such thing as broken law without a penalty. Now, sometimes the penalties are natural. You go down to Flo's whorehouse, you get a dose of clap, and okay, so that's natural, ordinary. You don't need a cop sitting down there at Flo's passing out tickets now. When you get AIDS, herpes, or VD, that's the message that you receive for the violation of that law. Now, along comes medical science. Now, medical science says, well, wait a minute, we're going to find a cure to this venereal disease, and they did, called penicillin, sofa drugs, and antibiotics. So, they now advertise it this way. Go ahead, go down to Flo's. Okay. Because in the event that you come down with a dose of syphilis or something like that, we sell forgiveness of sin. You can come to Mercy Medical Center, and we will treat you for this venereal disease. We will dispense to you for a price forgiveness of sin. And that way, you don't need to be concerned about this thou shalt not commit adultery bit. That law, that God, is not as powerful as the gods of modern medicine. That's the message that we all get. That's the message we all believe. It's the message we all practice. Until AIDS came along. No cure. The gods of medicine are impotent. And now you have a worldwide pandemic, and you have no idea how you're going to stop it or where it's going to end. That's the penalty that we all pay for the violation of that law. Thou shalt not commit adultery has a penalty. All laws have a penalty. If there wasn't a penalty, there wouldn't be a law. It would be a suggestion. Now, Dr. Wayland has said, well, that the relaxation of parental authority has always been found one of the surest indications of the decline of social order and the unfailing precursor of public turbulence and anarchy. Now, under the law, as we have already seen, parental authority is not merely relaxed, but it is totally set at defiance. What, we would ask, does parental authority amount to? In the matter of educating children, when a parent is not recognized as having any remedy as against the teacher for the wrongs that he may perpetrate against this parent's child, and when, as in California today, the parent is, in the eyes of the law, a criminal who ventures to send his own child to a school of his own choice, and at his own expense, without first going with his hat under his arm to a board of petty officials to beg for their permission to do so. Now, if parents any longer have the least vestige of authority over the all-important matter of their own children's education, which is not wholly subordinated to the private interests, prejudices, and petty spites of any and every little conclave of irresponsible upstarts who, by hook or by crook, can so manage an election day as to have their names on the tickets of the winning party, we should feel under many obligations if somebody would inform us what the remaining parental authority is, or where can that remaining parental authority be found. Is it not the almost unanimous cry on the part of parents throughout the length and breadth of our land that they can neither command the respect nor obedience of their children, and they are not our police courts, are not our police courts crowded, and our county prisons and state penitentiaries being filled with beardless boys, many of whom have had comfortable homes and have grown up in the society of respectable parents, but have never been under their parents' control? But perhaps we shall all be asked, why is it that neither politicians nor the parents of children have thus far done anything towards furnishing a remedy for all of these crying evils? We would answer the reasons are numerous, but the first and most important reason we shall assign is ignorance. Ignorance of the true and heaven-ordained relations between parent and child. Ignorance of the reciprocal duties which they respectively owe to each other. Yes, and ignorance, total ignorance of the foregoing terrible facts so clearly revealed by the United States Census report. Now let anyone who doubts the general ignorance of our people on the last subject test the matter by catechizing the first 10 men that you meet concerning the facts shown by our published tables. The truth is that the advocates of this New England school system have been so long, and they have been working yelling so loud, and they have been so long so persistent in proclaiming to the world its supposed excellencies that 9/10 of the world have, without the least investigation, concluded to accept it for all that its most enthusiastic admirers represent it to be. Were it not for the widespread and almost total ignorance on the part of parents as regards the poisonous and deadly fruits which they and their children and society at large are daily reaping from this anti-parental system of education, it could not survive a single month in its present condition. Oh, how true it is that ignorance is the mother of vice. Now there's still another reason why no remedy has been applied to this fearful malady, and it is a long-standing, deep-seated, and constantly fomented prejudice in favor of the public school system, which makes the politicians afraid to attack this monster lest they hurt their popularity. And there's still another difficulty, and that is the want of harmony among those who see and lament the terrible evils which this system is bringing on their country, and who are willing to make any and every sacrifice to avoid or avert those evils. One says, let us have the Bible in the schools. Another says, no, we don't want any Bibles in the school. I want no Bible in my school. Then a third says, let us divide the school funds amongst all the different religious denominations in such a manner that each denomination shall, as a body, have control of a portion of those funds corresponding with the number of its members. While a fourth may say, away with such silly nonsense, we have far too much ecclesiasticism in the public schools already. But is there not, we ask, a common ground whereupon every friend of educational reform can stand? Well, most undoubtedly there is. So let us recognize, just as the law of nature recognizes the right and the duty of all parents, having the ability so to do, to educate their own children in their own way and by the use of their own funds. After all, it is not less the interest than the duty of parents when they can do so to pay the cost of their own children's education and not to allow the state to pay it for them. So let it be remembered that the cost and care of properly feeding, clothing, and educating the child are but the price which nature demands of parents for the incomparable treasure of the child's love, honor, and obedience, and just in proportion to the extent to which parents neglect or refuse to pay this price, in precisely the same proportion do they forfeit their right to this inestimable boon. So let us suppose that the state should take upon itself to feed and clothe as well as to educate the child. Well, does anyone doubt that a child thus fed, clothed, and educated at the public expense would grow up almost wholly destitute of any parental affection? And who is so stupidly blind as not to see that the education of the child, after all, is the great nourisher of its affections? Respect, love, and a veneration do not depend near so much on either the source or the character of the food which enters the stomach as upon the source and character of that which is taken into the mind and heart. But in cases where parents have not sufficient worldly wealth to give their children a good elementary education, let the state aid them just exactly as it should aid them when necessary, with means to feed and clothe their children, rather than let them either starve or go naked, but for some the same reason that the state would not feed the children of its more needy citizens upon the most dainty and costly delicacies, nor clothe them in the finest silks and satins. So neither should be educated, neither should it educate them in their higher or merely ornamental sciences, which are not necessary for those avocations in which they are likely to engage in after their public education has been concluded. And when the state furnishes educational aid, let it be so always in harmony with the principles of parental guardianship over that child. And let the parent in such cases select the school, and the state then pay the teacher. Let this boon be extended to all who need state aid. Because without regard to differences in politics or religion, perhaps though we shall be told that so radical a change in the public school system as that suggestion would work the destruction of the system itself. Well, if that be so, then we would ask whether it is better for us to destroy that system or to let that system destroy us. Well, again, it may perhaps be objected that even if every parent in the land had the means and the privilege of educating his own children in his own way, even then there would always be found some parents in every community who would neglect this most sacred duty. And what ought to be done with such parents? Well, we answer, what ought to be done with those heartless parents who, having the means at hand, either of their own or such as have been furnished by the state, to comfortably feed and clothe their children, would, nevertheless, deliberately leave them to die of starvation or perish with cold? In either case, such parents should be punished as criminals against the laws both of God and society. But so long as the state undertakes to force upon the children of any class of parents a system of education which they cannot accept without a violation of the conscience and of nature's law, it is nothing less than the most cruel tyranny on the part of the state to make such a system compulsory. Now let every friend of educational reform unite in maintaining these plain, just, and most reasonable principles. And the day is not too distant when, with heaven's blessing, we shall restore parental authority, reestablish family government, and teach the raising or rising generation to love, honor, and obey not only their fathers and mothers, but also the laws, both of our God and our country. Now, that's quite a statement. I couldn't agree more. One of the problems that we see in the book of Proverbs is the lack of parental authority over children. After the Dr. Spook era, we've gotten to the point where we don't want to discipline our children. We don't want to spank them. And indeed, Social Lady doesn't want you to spank them either. The state wants to control you and your child, and they've got a motive. They've got an agenda. There's no doubt about it. But without discipline and without authority, children can't learn. Children running around, jumping up and down, they call it ADHD. So they want to give them a drug, calm them down. Can a child that's so drugged up that he can hardly walk learn? Have we taken leave of our senses? Children, you know, are active. Children have a lot of energy. So what's wrong with children having energy? Well, they're so hard to control. Children aren't hard to control when they're disciplined. You know, I used to be a kid. I had a lot of energy, and I was disciplined. I didn't have ADHD. I might have been a pain in the hiney for a lot of teachers, but I wasn't suffering from any ADHD. I was just suffering from, that kid needs a good belt across the head. He needs to be bounced off the wall a couple times. When discipline was imposed upon me, I calmed right down. My granddad used to have an old saying. He said, you know, you need to come back down to earth. I'd be floating around up there, you know, bouncing off the walls and bouncing off the ceiling. My granddad grabbed me, trashed me, and told me to sit down and shut up. And then I'd sit down and shut up. And then after a little while, I'd say, okay, now you can get up again. Calm down. All this medication, all this drug, all this witchcraft that you see going around here is a lack of discipline. That's 90% of it. Now, There probably is some physical problem here. It's called sugar. Sugar. You're feeding your children soda pop, 9 teaspoons of sugar that they can only digest 3 teaspoons of them. And I'm not sure a child can dispose of 3 teaspoons of a simple carbohydrate. It may not be that they can do that. Adults can only handle 3 teaspoons of sugar per day, refined sugar per day. 3 teaspoons a day. Hell, 1 Coke has 9. 3 times your daily allowance. I have students come in here, they can down a whole 12-pack of Coke in a day. We attend school here for 6 hours. We start at 9 in the morning, finish at 5 at night, take an hour and a half for lunch. I don't know what they're drinking at lunch. I'm not watching them. But I can watch them here in class. I mean, I've got Cokeaholics in here. If they're not drinking Coke, they're drinking Pepsi or something else. And we got one class of people that drink Mountain Dew. And then we got one guy in here. I couldn't believe this guy, but he was real. He was drinking Jolt. And I said, what is it? I've never heard of that. And he says, double the caffeine, double the sugar. 18 teaspoons of sugar, twice as much caffeine as Coca-Cola and Pepsi. Probably more than Mountain Dew. Jolt, they called it. All right, boys and girls, now there's that story. Now, the anti-parental school system, when it is dissected and when it's analyzed, we'll take that up next time. We'll take up this anti-parental. Now, you got parental schools. Those are homeschools. And about 2 million Americans, 2 million Americans can connect the dots. And they've taken their children out of school and they're educating them at home. We don't have any school shootings. Not in those schools. We don't have any ADHD in those schools. We have discipline. We have parental control. And we don't have rape, robbery, and pillaging in those schools. We don't have that going on in our parochial schools either. It's always in the public schools, and the public schools have an agenda. They're anti-parental. Remember we said we'd take a look at what causes this. It's the destruction of the family. It is the anti-parental attitude. It is the disobedience to the law that says honor your father and mother. That's the cause of our malady, the violation of that Fifth Commandment. All right, next time we'll take it up. Meanwhile, let me remind you that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard in more than 112 countries daily over the Internet. For more information about The Law School and Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Here, time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.